The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So this talk is called The Political Economy of Energy, and two terms that are actually kind of a bit complicated to wrap your head around just to begin with, right? When you think about what is energy, and on the one hand, from a science perspective, probably everybody knows that you can't create it or destroy it, and yet in society we constantly talk about energy production and energy consumption as if it's a thing when it's not a thing at all. And then you tack on a couple of other words about political economy. What is political economy? Well, this is a phrase that didn't arise up until the 18th century. In other words, it is synonymous with the rise of nation states and capitalism, the centrality of that. So what we're analyzing is the way in which something that is central to every living organism, right? How do I acquire the energy that I need in chemical form or in from the energy of the sun, if you're a plant? How do I acquire that in order to grow, in order to stay alive, and so on? So it's absolutely integral to everything that we do. And obviously, as human beings, we've moved on from the acquisition of energy through fire, which was a major technological and social change in human society several thousands of years ago, because, and you know, relates to the ways in which, for example, when the first colonists came over to New England, and they were shocked by the abundance of life here. They couldn't believe it. It's because the landscape was a constructed landscape by the Native Americans in order to facilitate that kind of thing that they needed, whether they were nomadic or semi-nomadic or agriculturally based. And of course, the colonists were a bunch of racists, so they never thought that that was possible. But going on from the acquisition of just fire, we've obviously moved through various different stages, one of which the majority of human history, certainly human civilization, the last 10,000 years, has been an organically based society, right? Based on the kind of energy that we would get from growing things, right? Either as crops with the Neolithic Revolution, or to feed the animals that we were then domesticating. It's only in the last couple of hundred years or so, 300 years, that we've been talking about moving from a purely kind of organic system, which is regulated by the seasons and by the growing season of plants, to a mineral-based energy system. And that energy system has greatly facilitated our ability to, obviously there was a population expansion with the Neolithic Revolution 10,000 years ago, 8,000 years ago, and since the rise of concentrated energy in the form of fossil fuels, we have gone through another massive expansion to today. And what I want to talk about is some aspects of how we try and understand what's going on with that, because there's everybody basically is talking about energy from some kind of framework, right? And I'm going to talk about, there's a whole number of books and articles, and it's really, wherever you look, this is a key question for society, whether we want to transition to a different kind form of energy production, right, which we're not actually talking about just a technical solution, right, although I'm principally today going to be talking about that, or whether we are going to continue with fossil fuel production with a lot of the negative impacts that I'm sure people are aware of and we've been talking about for the last couple of days at the conference. But there were severe limits to how productive any society could be when you're basing how much energy you get from the cycles of plants, right? And so the expansion of human society had real limits to it up until you can talk about the release of energy with fossil fuels. Obviously, there were some exceptions to that. There was the ability to capture windmills. And water wheels and things like that, but nevertheless, most of it was for heating and so on from burning organic material. So, what I was going to do is just to bring us up to today and then go backwards. Hopefully, you'll be able to hear. This is an audio clip of the Ukrainian ambassador speaking with the Undersecretary of State at the State Department that a few months ago, after the crisis in the Ukraine broke out in November, and they are discussing which of the three potential candidates they want to have in power in the Ukraine and how they're going to organize it. So I'm just going to play 3 minutes because it tells us a lot about the way in which energy is thought about by the United States and how they go about organizing things. Hopefully you'll be able to hear this. I apologize for the Josh actually managed to get me the slide present projector here at the last minute. But
my understanding from that call, that you tell me, was that the big three were going into their own meeting, and that Yats was going to offer in that context a three-way, you know, 3+1 conversation or 3+2 with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I think, I mean, that's what he proposed, but I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them, where Klitschko has been the top dog, he's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got. He's probably talking to his guys at this point, so I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all of this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written... Oh, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff?
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, but when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Sperry. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, I saw that.
He's now gotten both Sperry and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Sperry could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, fuck the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land jelly set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych. We'll probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
Right.
Thanks.
So, that's a pretty amazing piece of information. Like, these people are talking about who they want, who of the three people they want in power. They're referencing their key ally in the region, the European Union. Fuck the EU, right? Because they're sick of the prevarication and they want to get things done. They are going to get on board Ban Ki-moon, the executive director of the UN, and in order to make sure that everything's smoothed out there. And then they're going to call Joey in to make sure, do the attaboy thing, and represent the US government. So, interesting, so this was leaked. Who was it leaked by? Almost certainly the Russian government, because that's where it came out first. The tweets were coming from the Russian foreign ministry. The woman is the Undersecretary of State. And so she didn't deny it.
She apologized.
She apologized because Angela Merkel, for example, was outraged by the, not just the inappropriate language, but the way in which obviously they were publicly talking about this. So this is what was going on behind the scenes in December and January that has now led to, I don't know whether people can really see this very well, but here is the Caspian Sea, right? And enormous amounts of oil and gas have been found here, only in the last 10 or 15 years. And so this is a huge new area for exploration. The problem is that down here is a country where you don't see any pipelines, because how do you avoid getting the oil or the gas out coming through Iran, right? And over here is that they did actually build a pipeline up through Russia, but originally there was, the US had a plan, it was called Anywhere But Russia. And they went back and forth and back and forth, and they did actually, they were forced to build a pipeline this way, but it wasn't the main pipeline. The main pipeline came through here and avoided other places that have seen massive amounts of unrest. Grozny, for example, which was flattened by the Russian military, and comes down through Turkey. And I'd written just after the 300 Turkish miners were killed in the mine, and basically through the negligence of the corporations that were running the mines, called the title of that article, "Was It Murder?" But Turkey sees itself as a key player now in the new way of getting all of the oil and gas out of the Caspian, down through Turkey, and wants to be seen as a transit point to get the oil somewhere where it can be used, which is the Mediterranean Sea. Of course, also, apart from trying to avoid Iran, you've also got to avoid Iraq and Syria. And then you see there were plans at one point, as people probably know, for pipelines to go through Afghanistan via UNOCAL. And that's why the Taliban were in Houston, along with the Northern Alliance. But you'll see that there are now new pipelines, and you've probably heard that there is a $400 billion deal that was just sealed, biggest deal ever, between Russia and China to take more oil and gas that way. So the amount of jockeying for position just in this new area to release the oil and gas through here, and they want to develop it also in Turkmenistan, because there's more oil and gas up here that they haven't even developed yet. Massive, massive oil fields, tens of billions of barrels of oil and gas, or trillions of cubic meters. And so more and more pipelines are going to be built, and the question is, how are they going to be built? Because over here is the Ukraine, and a large part of, I mean, who thought even a few months ago that we would be in the news talking about the dissolution and the dismemberment of the Ukraine on the borders of the European Union, where pieces are getting cut off and there's a secessionist war fomented and aided by the Russians, who've already taken the Crimea, where the European Union now has to worry about how it's going to get 30% of its natural gas, which almost all comes from Russia. So they just released a new energy security document, the European Union, the people who supposedly love to diversify away from fossil fuels. And you have to ask yourself, why do they want to do that? What is pushing the European Union to do that, especially when that document actually stipulates one of the things that they're going to do? Apart, they are talking about more renewables, but they're also talking about the sustainable production of fossil fuels. That's a quote. I don't know what that means exactly. It is in the, thank you, it is in the report. So this is just, I mean, any way you look on the globe, I'm not going to go through all the different areas. We should talk about analytically how this has played out over the years in terms of energy, oil, gas, and coal. And what are the motivations for different countries to do what they do outside of whether there are protest. I'm not going to talk about the other side of the story in terms of protest movements and so on so much. I'm going to be talking about the motivations of the political economy of the people who make the decisions about energy production, because it's so central to all that we do. And when you think about it, sometimes I have my students come into the room and I have the lights off, and I start lecturing or talking or whatever else, and at some point just somebody asks to put the lights on because they can't see what I'm doing, as you probably can't see this. They ask, and I ask them, well, what did you just do? So, turned on the lights, but where did that come from, right? How do we even manufacture that? And most people nowadays, you know, as an educator, I know you can't go into an energy production facility. Very, very difficult, right, to even figure out what's going on with the energy in your own country. And surely that's a major aspect of a democratic society. That is one of the ways in which people talk about the reduction of the state. Actually, under neoliberalism, the state has been increased in power in certain very specific areas, one of which is the securitization of the energy supply system and the militarization of it and the lack of democracy. I don't know whether people can necessarily see this either, unfortunately, but this is from northwestern Spain. This is just to give like a longer perspective on kind of energy use. This is the way in which mountains have been washed away by the high pressure application of water to get the type of alluvial soil here to wash off into the rivers and then collect all of the gold, actually, was being mined. But you need an enormous amount of energy to transport the water and get it under high pressure through narrower and narrower pipes in order to sluice away the mountains, right? Massive ecological degradation. How was this done? And when was it done? Well, this is 2,000 years ago. This is the Romans.
Oh, my God.
So, obviously, they would... Yeah, and it's still obviously there today. So, and these are big places, you know, I don't know whether you can see, but it's a large area. And so that was slave power. Right. So what we're talking about now, of course, is going from human or animal energy production and use and harnessing that in all kinds of horrendous ways, and now going global or having gone global. And there are many ways in which whatever kind of food you eat or water you drink or any kind of other healthy activities that you may or may not engage in. This is the picture I took of the local atmosphere in LA, and you can't really see LA because there is this covering, which is not clouds, but is what is more or less permanently in the bowl of LA. And it's true that the air has cleaned up a lot since, because we've got environmental regulations since the 1970s. Things are a lot better. But New York is, you know, most Americans breathe not just particulates, but all kinds of other things that are deeply embedded in your lungs that you never get out. And so, and if you can also break that down and talk about, I'll talk about how that's broken down in a little bit. But this is not just obviously a developed world problem. It's how do you get tied into a system that forces you to produce energy in ways that you may well know are socially and ecologically destructive in many ways, but you need to, you have no choice anymore. So yeah, this was from 2007, Hugo Chavez on May Day, oil, the road to socialism. And so Venezuela, the overwhelming majority of Venezuelan income is from oil and gas production as they sell it overseas. So we have to think about, well, what would it mean for a country such as Venezuela to, what options does it have within the system that we currently operate under? And this obviously applies to many other countries, not just Venezuela. But a state that has become essentially what is described at, by Daniel Yergin in his book, The Quest, from which I mercilessly stole some of the graphics in this presentation, is a really extremely interesting historical overview of the development of energy over the last few decades, and all his conclusions are things that we would radically disagree with, nevertheless, very interesting in terms of describing some states as petrostates, so that some states have 70, 80, 90% of their GDP, their income, 50% of their GDP, dependent on oil and gas. So Nigeria is another example. So to kind of wrap your head around what is political economy, this is a question that I think is worth thinking about, right? Because for a long time, under Bush, everybody thought that, the second Bush, a lot of people thought that this was tied to the oil and gas administration of the Republican Party. And yet we've had the exact same policies under Obama. In fact, an expansion. And so rather than talking about Democrats or Republicans, we've got to be talking about, well, what are the contours of the global economy as it relates to energy? Or how should we explain this? The fact that Germany has got 30% of its energy now, wants to get to 50% from solar and wind, and yet anybody who's been to Northern Europe, there's not an awful lot of sun there, and this map just shows that actually the solar resources up here are very poor, medium here, going down into Southern Europe, quite good, but nevertheless, Germany is building lots and lots of solar panels and investing $25 billion to change its grid in order to bring energy from the north, where it's windy, to the south, where people live. And so why is Germany doing that? How would we explain that? Or conversely, why is it not happening in the United States, where where this is a map of solar energy possibilities, where the black region in the southwest has enormous potential for solar energy, or the center of the country has enormous wind potential, and a lot of people think about the U.S. is not going to suffer necessarily as badly as other places in the world under climate change, but this map actually highlights something that's very important to take into account and helps to explain the polar vortex and a lot of other things, because the U.S., in contrast to Europe, for example, is shaped like a giant funnel. So on one side, you've got the Rockies, right? On the other side, you've got the Appalachians. And it goes down like this, which explains why the wind gets funneled down here from the north, which is also why the polar vortex can come down if you destabilize the jet streams. But it means that because that moving air can go backwards and forwards, it also means that the U.S. has over 90% of all tornadoes in the world, almost exclusively in the United States. There are huge climate change impacts that we're already seeing, particularly in California with the drought, as a consequence of some of the geography of the continent, in contrast to, for example, Europe, where the mountain ranges go east-west and stop some of the cold air from Siberia coming down. And what's going on with energy is so interesting and despicable and horrifying, because everybody knows what's actually going on with regard to emissions. So this is the latest IPCC report that just came out. I don't know, you don't really need to pay attention to here, but this is 2000, right? And you can see, in all the time that we've been talking about renewable energies and doing more and so on and so forth, and the build out of solar and wind and whatever else, this is a graph of emissions. Emissions have expanded. The yellow one is from fossil fuels. So the majority of it is from fossil fuel production. And the rate is increasing. And this is also a time that coincides with high oil prices, although declining natural gas prices, and so high oil prices are not constraining emissions, quite the opposite, and neither is the build out of renewables, because building renewables is not, they don't exchange one for the other. It's additive, right? It's all of the above, quite literally. There's a couple of important things they took out of this report that was recently released because it started to sound bad for certain countries. Two things that were taken out. One was that 70% of the emissions in CO2 emissions in the world come from just 10 countries, and 50% come from just two, right? The United States and China. So unless we're talking about those 10 countries, what are we really talking about in terms of having an impact? I don't think you can read this, but I will just tell you, the flip side of it is, on the one hand, everybody's got that information because they commissioned the reports and it's an intergovernmental panel that they have to go and attend and read. So the energy reaching the Earth from the sun, 101,000 terawatts, or power, I should say, more accurately. And we currently use 15 terawatts. So many orders of magnitude more energy reaches us from the sun than we use, which gives you an indication of what is possible. You know, we have to capture 0.1% for our needs. So here's a graph of oil prices and how they've changed from 1861, which is basically the birth of the modern oil industry, all the way through to 2012. This is dollars per barrel. So we see here, this is 73, right? Where the West is embargoed after the US is supplying weapons to Israel so that they can win the 73 war, otherwise they would have lost. And OPEC embargoes, and so oil prices get driven up. This in 79 is the Iranian Revolution. Oil prices again increase. And what's interesting about this, what happens in that time period is from 73 to 79, what does the US, there's a whole number of different policy changes, right? A reaction to this, interruption in energy, a massive debate. So we get the Carter Doctrine, right, in 79 that says this is a national security issue. We will do anything that we can, military included, in order to secure our energy. There's also a push, and a genuine push, with lots of investment in the 70s for solar and wind and so on, and actually a genuine industry in solar and wind develops in the United States. There are different ways in which the political elite respond to this kind of crisis. However, more production comes online through the 80s and production drops, price drops to insignificant amounts, $10, $20 a barrel. So it wasn't just that Reagan was a right-wing nut in many regards, and rather forgetful. I remember him being on TV, not recalling anything that had happened during the Iran-Contra War, along with his chum, Ollie. It wasn't just that, he had once said that once you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. But when he was actually governor of California, he actually implemented a whole range of environmental regulations. It's one of the reasons that California actually has more regulations than other states. There are other reasons for that. But he changed. And the reason he changed, because the US state didn't see the need to respond to this anymore. So it's partly about politics, but it's also tied to economics. And one of the important things that I think is, I would want to emphasize is all of this discussion about peak oil and all the rest of it and all this kind of Malthusianism around end of resources, and I'm going to talk about Michael Clare and stuff, is completely overblown. Actually, this is the fifth time we've run out of oil since 1861. And every time there has been more oil coming online. I think we know the reasons for that. So, but there's very little talk, and not realistic talk, I don't think, of peak oil, peak anything in terms of gas and oil and coal anymore. And there are reasons for that too. So most recently, of course, there was another spike in, this is 92, and the first invasion of Iraq, and then 2003, second invasion. And then we get something dramatically different, right? Which is what has led to the argument. Thanks on peak oil, but it was really nothing to do with actually not having enough. There were significant changes in the early 2000s that took a lot of oil out of production. One was Iraq, the other was Venezuela, and the other was Nigeria. So that between those three, and then there was another factor that is super important. I really wanted Paul Kellogg to address this when somebody asked him what was the role of energy in the changing corporate nature of the world yesterday, but he didn't, and I thought I'd get some answers. But yesterday, but anyway, and you can see that these are U.S. gasoline prices. They mirror very closely what was going on with the oil price barrel, which is not surprising, but in a certain sense it is. And this graph is quite unique to the United States. And the reason for that is when oil goes up, gasoline goes up an enormous amount in the United States. Immediately you get an increase of the price at the pump. Why is that? It's because only about 40 cents of what you pay in gasoline in your tank is taxes to the government. The rest of it is just the price of oil. So if the oil price changes, then your gasoline changes. On the other hand, in Europe, about $5 per gallon is from taxes. So it can be adjusted, and actually the price is not reflective of as variable as it is here. And so the outcry with a change in oil price is not as much, because it's actually buffered by the way in which oil is priced. So, you know, if we're talking about geopolitics, we should probably bring in Henry Kissinger, and he has very definitive views, and obviously shaped a lot of U.S. Energy policy through the 1970s and all the way through to today, really. Because the other thing that happened during the oil crisis of 73, when people were queuing up and so on and so forth, well, there was OPEC, but they formed another group, right? The International Energy Agency was formed, the IEA, which is all of, if OPEC is the producer countries, then the IEA is the consuming countries. And what they decided there and then was, we are going to form a treaty, we're going to have a group of countries who all have the same interests in mind in order to make sure this never happens again. It's also when the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was set up, not just here, but around the world, and a mechanism put in place globally for a way to cope with fluctuations in oil. If there was ever a coordinated attempt by the producer countries to do this again. Since that time, there's also been an attempt to boost non-OPEC oil, so that this is OPEC and this is non-OPEC. And so there is a relative decline in the importance of OPEC in world liquid fuel production in comparison to non-OPEC countries. So this is a significant rearrangement of global power relations. This is the US. And so you can see, actually, through the 40s and 50s, it's the biggest producer of oil in the world, and stays relatively constant. There's some decline, but now, of course, exciting news, the US production is going up enormously at the moment. I'm going to skip over that. Now, we're not the only ones worrying about this. As Fred was pointing out in his talk earlier, this is the World Economic Forum at Davos. Klaus Schwab, he founded it. They're worried about a whole number of things. This is their top 10 list of threats. Fiscal crises in key economies, structurally high unemployment, water crises, severe income disparity, failure of climate change mitigation and adaptation, greater incidence of extreme weather events, global governance failure, food crises, failure of a major financial mechanism or institution, profound political and social instability. Quite a list, right?
Thanks.
Longer than ours, maybe. And it's interesting how many of those things are directly connected to energy, climate, because you've also got to recognize, obviously, that if we're talking about energy production in terms of thermoelectricity, then we're talking, you know, coal plants and so on, gas plants, then we're talking about nuclear plants, we're talking about an enormous amount of water, and fracking even more so. As at the exact stage when we're facing water shortages in certain areas. And then on top of that, food production. Because one of the calculations is that for every calorie of food that we produce, we actually use 10 calories of fossil fuel energy. And so the price of food is direct, you know, that's one statistic on just how unsustainable this crazy system is. One calorie of food takes 10 calories of energy from fossil fuels. Because everything about food production is related to fossil fuels, at least in industrialized food production. So this is a very interesting book that Michael Clare wrote, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. But his analysis, I know Aaron has a fairly negative view of what analysis is contained in here, and I agree with that, because his analysis is very much rising power, shrinking planet, as if the whole thing is a litany of what we're running out of, which I think completely misunderstands the nature of capitalism and how it goes about organizing things, and also the nature of chemistry, to be honest. And another really interesting book, but incorrect analysis, in my opinion, on really worthwhile reading. His thesis is actually democracy spread because of the coal industry, which is based on high amounts of labor input in localized places that was not taken far away and transported overseas and so on, like oil is. It was not capital intensive like oil was. And so democracy was contingent on the rise of the coal industry, and then collapsed again with the rise of the oil industry, because oil doesn't employ that many people. They're far away from population centers often, or out in the ocean, and have less ability to control production than coal workers did, especially when coal was connected to the railways and so on and so forth. Interesting thesis. I think it's a bit extreme, especially when you think that actually they solved the problem of the labor intensity of coal production by just blowing the tops off the mountains, and having open cast mines, which reduces the number of workers 10 to 1. And there's all kinds of other things that we could say about that I think are important and lacking. And he's somebody else, Timothy Mitchell, for all his really interesting analysis, is somebody else who believes we're running out of oil. And I'm running out of time, but I don't think I even need to quote from this, because the front cover says it all. Right, Michael Levy is a really influential energy analyst, and so this is a picture of a U.S. oil refinery with a massive American flag on it. And so what he's proposing we should do is all of the above. Is the best win-win solution is that we can develop everything, and we can do oil and coal and gas in environmentally friendly ways through sequestration and these other technologies that don't exist. But, you know, don't let that stop you. We have large, you know, important segments of the ruling class saying that we should be doing something. This is post-Sandy, New York City, right? Bloomberg had this put on his newspaper. This is one of the, you know, he's $25 billion. He got the law changed in New York City to allow him to run 3 times. Right. Then even more interestingly, he got it changed back once he got in, so that it was back to 2, because obviously he's the only one who could be trusted with 3 terms in the United States. Elected people in the city council did that. So how he could do that, but he's not changing U.S. Policy with regard to energy, despite his... and just in terms of Sandy, this is actually off the coast of Singapore, but there was no gasoline for weeks after Sandy, right? And then they eventually managed to get it by number plate that you could go and fill up. There was lots of other things going on, but that was one of the things. Why was that? It's because actually there were very few pipelines going to the northeast. And all of the, I wanted to show you a map. There's some really great map, interactive maps that the US government has put out now, showing where all the pipelines are, where all the oil terminals are. It's like the whole country is covered in stuff. And all the, it's because the 13 refineries in the northeast were all knocked out. So there were tankers waiting, but they had nowhere to refine the oil, and they had nowhere to get it from. And all they could do is ship it up from the Gulf, and then they couldn't land it. And so it very quickly became obvious the centrality of energy to the northeast, and what happens if you don't do anything, and that's the Rockaways, now put on by these billionaires that Fred mentioned, Bloomberg, Henry Paulson, Tom Steyer. I'll save you the depressing news there on what they think is going on. National Academy of Sciences, premier institution, says we can totally do away with coal production. It would actually save $50 billion a year, and we could still give a full pension of 50 grand a year to every single miner that we pensioned off. And so this supposed disparity between labor and the environment is, as we probably know, completely false. But National Academy of Sciences is proving, if you want that broken down, I highly recommend reading the NAACP report, Cold-Blooded, on the disproportionate impact by race and class, and because it highlights that the energy issue is also a race issue. Another government report just out, people may have heard this is not a projection, this is all about how bad things are right now, state by state, as a way of trying to change things. And yet, this is actually what we're faced with. We're talking about $7.42 trillion in the 100 largest oil and coal corporations. We know that there are almost 3,000 gigatons of carbon in the ground, known. We can only burn 560 gigatons, and they spend $2 billion a day looking for more. We went through a trillion barrels of oil in the first trillion in about 130 years. We went through the second trillion in 22 years. And so the amount of acceleration maps the expansion of the economy, which is mapped by lots of other things. Amazingly enough, there's more land given over to oil and gas production in the United States than crops. And of course, much of the crop land is for ethanol production, 40% of oil. And so it's the single biggest land use in the US. And this helps to explain why the US has gone down this path. And I don't know whether I'll get to it, why Germany and other countries have gone down another path. This is a really telling graph, I think. This is CO2 emissions per capita from 1950 to 2004. Guess who the red line is? Go USA. So about 20 metric tons per person. And here is the EU on 10, half, right? Wow. And here down here is China and India and so on. And so what this means is the US is much less able to adapt to a low carbon regime than other countries, which is why the EU pushed for a 15% reduction in Kyoto, 15% reduction, and the US fought for 8. The reason that the US fought for a lower number and the EU for a higher number was down to the fact that the EU knew that it could outcompete the US on the basis of carbon, and so it would actually get at a competitive advantage by forcing the US to change because it's so much less efficient. And so the US is now put in a position, not because of any administration or anything like that, but has to direct its energy towards wrecking climate talks, and then assembles a coalition to help it do so when it needs. Because the other aspect of it, not only has the whole infrastructure of this country been predicated on cheap fossil fuel energy, but it has a lot of it, and it's just discovered even more. So, as the Wall Street Journal reported at the end of last year, the US rises to number one energy producer. Oh, this is a map of gas pipelines in the country. That's compressor stations in the country. So we're talking about a lot of infrastructure. So now with shale, that's 8 trillion barrels around the world of extra stuff that we didn't have 10, 15 years ago. Didn't even know about, really. I mean, we knew it was there, but we didn't have access to it, I should say. There have been a whole series of technological innovations that have allowed the extraction of previously uneconomic, too difficult to access oil and gas, and 6 trillion of those barrels are in the United States. And this is such a profitable industry and so connected to everything else. People act like the oil industry can be segregated. We talked a little bit about this in some other meetings. The oil industry can be segregated off, and if we get rid of the evil oil and gas companies and coal companies, then the rest of it will be okay. But it's inextricably linked. If you think about car production, steel, rubber, asphalt, everything revolves around energy, transportation for oil, electricity production for coal. The Obama administration has facilitated this. In 2013, the US exported more liquid fuels than any other country in the world. Even though we import the vast majority of the 20 million barrels that is used today, it's not the right kind. And according to Scientific American, we should be fracking everywhere all the time, anywhere we can find. And that's why Foreign Affairs, this edition of Foreign Affairs, big fracking deal, as in big money deal, is what they mean by big fracking deal. Shale and the future of energy. A whole litany of things about how much money is going to be made from shale. There's a coming Arctic boom. How exciting is that? And oil production is going up everywhere. North America, predicted by Citibank to be the new Middle East. Investment in gas infrastructure, $8 trillion. And it's true that coal production has gone down here, but that doesn't mean to say they're not digging the coal out of the ground and selling it somewhere else. So coal exports have hugely increased to China. And, well, this is a graph of what's gone on with Chinese energy and Chinese production. A massive increase since 2000. I was just in Vietnam, and they have a plan for quadrupling the size of the economy and doubling the size of the energy. Thanks. And Paul showed us a somewhat similar graph yesterday, but this shows the transition in where power is moving with regard to energy and also with regard to one of the things that's produced with energy, which is cars. So this is the US production of cars up to 2010. This is the Chinese production. And so starts off almost negligible just 14 years ago and is now outstripping the United States significantly in car production. But how many cars per 1,000 of the population? China, India, almost nobody. The US, over 800 cars per 1,000 population. And so if you were a capitalist, put yourself in the shoes of a capitalist for a second, where would you be trying to market your cars? Where would you be trying to sell them? Well, there's an enormous market. And that explains why energy production is gone through the roof in China. In 2000, 14 years ago, energy production in China was a third of what it is here. In 5 years, they double what they can, the number of power stations and the amount of energy that they're producing. In 5 years. And now they have more energy production capacity than the United States. So this is a phenomenal change in the world economy and the political economy of energy. And I guess I don't really have time to go into this, but Foreign Affairs is the advisor to what they should be doing about this kind of stuff, right? And how do we make sure that things aren't spinning out of control. And so they read history too, and come up with the solutions based on what they think is going to happen and what they should be doing. So they're very worried about Russia. They're very worried about, even more worried about China, and other, and Iran too, in terms of energy production, and are making plans to cope with it. So I guess I'll leave it there, and we'll have a conversation. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.